To go. Well, golly, look at this, you guys. My goodness, a room full of people that I know and love and have worked with so long. I'm really, really honored. And Uncle Bill suggested that you might go to sleep because we had a really nice dinner. But you know what? If I start getting a little bit boring, well, just pinch me or something, you know? Maybe I'll fall asleep because I'm really, really full. Well, I don't know exactly. The butterflies that were in my stomach just turned into seagulls. And it feels like my heart is getting ready to come out of my mouth. And wondering, gee, you know, what is it can I tell you about me that would be interesting? I had a very, very uneventful childhood, I guess. I was a little spoiled because I was the only girl born to three brothers. And so my mother really did a job on me, really did a job on me. And I was spoiled, and I was nosy, and I always liked to interfere, and they had a real job with me. I ran away from home when I was, I think, about 3 years old. I didn't run too far. There was an ice cream place just around the corner, so I think they knew where to find me all the time. I've always been heavy. There's some pictures of me out there. You'll see the youngest picture I have of me is when I was about maybe 9 or 10 years old. And so when this is over, you can go and take a look at some of my pictures, some of the people that meant a lot to me. And you will see an awful lot of pictures of my mother because my mother, of course, was always a shining light for me. She's the one that, of course, besides giving me life, really taught me everything I've learned in my lifetime, including how to go fishing, which I never did like to because I didn't like to see the poor little worms squiggling at the end of a hook. And I didn't like to go in the water either because I almost drowned when I was, I don't know, 2 years old, and so I was scared of the water. But I was very close to my mother, and my mother was hoping to raise a traditional daughter, but you know, golly, I have broken with tradition so many times, beginning with, of course, not being the little girl that my mother wanted me to be. I was always very tomboyish. I was always climbing trees and jumping. I loved to play Tarzan, and I was always Tarzan. I was never Jane. And I just loved to swing, you know, from the trees. And oh my goodness, my childhood was very happy. Very happy until maybe I was about 10 years old when my family broke up. Unfortunately, we suffered pretty much the same thing that a lot of families suffer, and that is that my dad started taking up drinking after 27 years of marriage to my mother. And I think I drove my dad to drink, to be honest with you. You know, but anyway, my mother broke with tradition, leaving my dad because of his like of drinking and couldn't stand it anymore. So we came out to California, and that was quite an experience. I don't think I had really gone anywhere further than maybe about 100 miles from where I was born. So California was a really, really strange experience for me. I was just about almost 10 years old when we. Oh, yeah. Thank you, everybody. See, I knew you guys were going to help me. I was born with one foot on real close to the border in Texas, way at the very southern tip of Texas, and I barely was born in the United States. My parents are immigrants. My dad came from San Luis Potosí in Mexico, and he's descended from the Aztecs. And my mother came from Nuevo León, which is also more to the interior. And she came from the Maya, so we're a mess. Aztecs and the Mayans together, my God. No wonder I turned out such a mess, huh? We were always battling. But anyway, I don't know how my mother and my father wound up together. My mother married when she was 15, and that leaves a lot of questions in my mind, you know, what happened back then. But anyway, whatever happened, my mother was married at 15. She was a mother at 16. Not with me because I'm the baby. I'm the very last. And I really always, all my life, I've thought I've been an oops, you know. And in the days and age where contraception was not practiced, I came along. I think my mother had given up faith that she was going to have a girl and was going to continue to have boys. But anyway, Harlingen is the name of the town where I was born. I was born on a really cold day in January 29th, 1945. And in those days in January, it is super cold. There's icicles that hang from the eaves. You know, it's so cold, things freeze up really quick. And then conversely, in the summertime, it's so hot, you can't stand it. I can barely stand it right now. I was born at home. In those days, women could choose to have their children at home. And so I was. My mother says I was a real screamer. And I think I've been screaming ever since, and that's why I'm hoarse. But anyway, my mother was a very traditional woman. And she taught me all the arts that she was taught. And I can do all kinds of things, but I don't because I was very tomboyish. But I know how to sew and cook and clean. I know how to cook, huh? Yeah, I know how to cook. You guys have let me know that. Of course, my children and my daughter, my oldest girl, sitting over there, who gave me 3 grandchildren, 2 of who are here tonight. My namesake is sitting over there somewhere. I'm surprised. Is she inside the house? Hi, sweetheart. Yeah, sometimes she's like me. She likes to go away without letting people know. Where was I, Jerry?
When you moved to California.
I moved to California. My goodness, that changed my life. I was no longer a coddle little girl because my mother had to go to work, and my mother had never worked out of her home in her life. She was a homemaker. And when she came here, a single woman at that point with 2 kids, my brother and myself, she had to go to work. So we wound up in Oceanside is the first place we stopped, where my mother had been told that the flowers were beautiful there. And yes, indeedy, we picked a lot of gladiolas. They're beautiful down there. That's where I got to love gladiolas, and that's the first time my mother ever did any field work other than maybe going out to the cotton fields. And yes, we picked cotton in those old days, but never really having to work to make a living to support her family. It was, you know, because she had to work, and that's what she had to do. We didn't like Oceanside very much. My mother was not happy there. There was not too much to do besides going fishing in the ocean, because my mother loved to fish. But she couldn't make very much money picking gladiolas. The pay wasn't very good at that time. So we made the decision to move to the valley, where my mother was told, as most people are told, that here you could rake the money up from under the trees. That's a story that's told over and over and over again. So we wound up in Farmersville, little town. I'm sure most of you know where Farmersville is. I started going to J.E. Hester School, but by the time I got there, I was really traumatized by, and I never really accepted it, but I was traumatized by my parents' separation. And I kind of fell back in school. I was always a very good student, and I kind of fell back. And I had a teacher. You know, teachers are so beautiful. Who's a teacher here? Oh, my God, look at that. Yeah. Mrs. Henninger, yes, definitely. Mrs. Henninger was one of my elementary school teachers, and had it not been for Mrs. Henninger, I don't think that I would have made it through school, because I had against me, first of all, Farmersville was, and I don't use the term badly because we grew up, calling the people that came from Oklahoma Okies, right? They called us, I forgot the term anyway, but they were called Okies, and it was kind of difficult to get, you know, for us to mix. I don't know why. I had all kinds of problems, and one of my worst tormentors, God rest his soul, was Gary Meeks, who later became chief of police in Farmersville. He tormented me, poor guy, you know. I forgave him, and not too long before he and his granddaughter had that terrible accident, I went and I told him that he had made my life miserable and why he had made my life miserable. And we wound up friends, and That made me feel so good. I had all these years of resentment, and unfortunately, based on what Gary did, that kind of put me very suspicious of any other white man. And it was weird because, guess what? I married a white man. But anyway, that's later on in life. My mother started working in the fields again here. She loved to pick oranges. She worked for the same orange grower out of Farmersville. I used to remember his name a few years ago. I remembered it. Now I've forgotten it. But anyway, for years. And so I loved to climb trees. And guess who used to have to pick the oranges that hung in the middle of the tree? And I loved that. And we made a pretty good living. I mean, honestly, we cannot complain. My mother was a very good orange picker. She got fired a lot from her jobs because she could never keep quiet, because things were happening in the fields that shouldn't have been happening, that don't happen now, such as sexual harassment. There were no toilets. And so in order for me, and little girls always have to go to the bathroom, you know that, for me to go to the bathroom, that meant that my mother was not going to pick as many oranges as we needed to pay the gas, you know, or pay the rent. So she was always complaining, and when she did, and the mayordomo got tired of her, well, bye-bye, you know. But anyway, she worked for this one guy for many years, and that's where my mother learned that to speak up is really golden, and she taught me that too. I did have some incidences of harassment at work when I was very little, because I always went to work with my mother on weekends and on holidays. I was always out there, and I think I picked everything that this valley has to offer. My mother loved oranges, but I went on, I picked peaches and grapes and everything. The grapes, yeah, we get out of the grape fields looking like monkeys. Everything's so messy. But anyway, I got through that little piece of my life got through elementary school. We made a decision to move again from Farmersville when I graduated from middle school and I was going to go to high school. Farmersville didn't have a high school at that time, so we either had to choose to go to Exeter or come to Visalia, and my mother chose to go to Visalia. And that's where we lived for the rest. Well, my mother lived there until she died. And I had a very, very good high school years. Sometimes people like to think that, well, you know, it was miserable because I never did a lot. But I did an awful lot. I got involved in all kinds of events. I mean, I was part of the Gigantea. And I think, and you keep me straight, Angie. All right, Angie and I go back, how many years? More years than you care to remember, huh? 41 years, yeah, we went through high school. I was a Gigantea, one of the reporters, and that's my way of getting to know people and meeting people and writing about people, and I think that's where I honed my writing abilities, because even if I do say so myself, I think I write pretty well. But anyway, yes, Redwood High School. Yes, Redwood High School, and I was a reporter for the Gigantea. Is the Gigantea still alive? Yeah? The school newspaper, yeah. That was in the days when the Chans were there. Lawrence Chan ran for... Oh, yeah? That was a long, yeah, yeah. Yeah, really. I'm sorry to hear it took him so long to make it, but anyway, I was so good with typing, and you know, and I was really good. I mean, when I was a junior in high school, I entered a contest, and I almost won the statewide contest, and I came in at like 106 words a minute. So I was excellent in clerical skills, which really helped me a lot, but high school was wonderful. I loved to work on term papers, And I always got in groups of the kids that I consider to be really smart, because they would do all the research and they would put together the papers. And guess what? I typed them and they looked really nice and neat. So we always got really good grades. We worked as a group. And I graduated from high school. I wouldn't know what the GPA was. I mean, in those days, we didn't know what GPAs were. But I graduated with like about a B+. And so I consider myself to be, you know, a little smart.
What year was that?
1964. That was a turning point in my life. Graduated in June of 1964, and I was kind of hanging around. My mother wasn't making me go to work in the fields anymore. Her daughter was educated, and so she wanted her daughter to go on to bigger things, but she didn't know what bigger things were in store for me. So, you know, I started looking for a job, and in those days, a girl like me could go to work at Bailey's. Bailey's, remember, the putting together the clothes, or go to work at the telephone company, which is still there, but then they actually occupied, hired women to do the PBXs and all that. I didn't want to do that. So I ran into this, actually he was a friend of my mother's, my family's, Eddie Cuellar, and I think there is some people remember him, Bill probably remembers, Eddie Cuellar, who used to help my mother with his, her income tax. Well, you know what? He told my mother, your daughter can do it. She's smart, you know? So I started doing my parents' income tax. And I learned how to do that from a very tender age. Actually, I was 13 years old when I was doing my mother's income tax, believe it or not. But anyway, after I graduated, Eddie Cuellar was working with American Friends Service Committee, the Farm Labor Program. And right then, they were in the process of putting together self-help enterprises, which I'm sure most of you know what self-help enterprises. Anybody doesn't know what self-help enterprises is? I'll give a very brief overview. You don't know what a self-help is? Okay. Self-help enterprises, well, back in the 50s, I guess, Bard and Olga McAllister were sent here to do some work. They had all kinds of trouble finding a house, and Bard went out and worked in the fields, and they were trying to find a place to live, and they saw how deplorable the housing situation here was, and affordable housing was unheard of. And since he went out and worked in the fields, he found from his friends that there was no housing here. So they thought to put together a group, you know, and with a basic, with doing what's called sweat equity. In other words, the people would do their own building rather than having to put down a big down payment on their homes, which they couldn't afford. So they started getting together. They got a group together and built a few homes. The first, I believe, were in Goshen. And it was a very small operation for a while there. They occupied the old Employment Development Department building across the street from where the convention center is now. And Bob Marshall, well, of course, you were director of the Self-Help Enterprises, right?
I was the second director after Howard Washburn.
Second director. Yes. Well, not to make it too long, Self-Help Enterprises has gone wild. And I helped put together the applications for the granting, the funding, and everything, and it just took off. I'll come back to self-help enterprises a little bit later on. But anyway, it was at that time we were putting together self-help enterprises that I started learning about the American Friends Service Committee, the Quakers and their beliefs, and, you know, how they believed in peace, peaceful, and peace and justice. And I started hearing all these things that Bard was bringing back about things that were going out in the country and, you know, in our own community. And one of the big things right then was the black people that were fighting for the right to vote back in the 60s, mid-60s. And so the American Friends Service Committee is always known for sending groups of people to join peace efforts and things like that. And I jumped on it, and a few people from the Friends Service, and I was one of the people that traveled to Alabama And actually joined the march with Cesar Chavez from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama, back in 1965. And Martin Luther King. I'm tired. Anyway, and I was not honored with being able to even shake his hand, because if you can imagine, the night before the march started, it was, we wouldn't fit in this whole area. It was so many people that had actually gone out there to be part of the movement, and I was flabbergasted that so many people could move together to bring something about that heretofore had not happened. And for me to be marching with Martin Luther King at that time, it was awesome. I just cannot even begin to describe my feelings. I was 19 years old. I had never really been away from home, from my mother, for that long. And here I was going to a state where I knew nobody, except for the people I traveled with. We marched maybe for about a half a day, and we were pulled off the march line. There was a lot of violence that really, really made me feel bad, how a human being could be so bad to other human beings. And we were pelted with rocks and rotten eggs and ripe tomatoes and, all kinds of names being hurled. You can just imagine. A couple of the other people that had gone with the American Friends Service Committee to join the same march had gotten killed. I think two people died from the American Friends Service Committee. So we were pulled off the march line. It became very dangerous at that point, so we had to come back. But by the time that we started on our trip back from Alabama, the group of people marching had grown. It was, I don't even remember. I mean, it was thousands upon thousands of people. And the most impressive thing is that the people from the community there were so impressed that so many white people were coming from other parts to join this march. And it was very fantastic. I mean, it was something, the atmosphere there was unbelievable. People just couldn't believe this. And there was so much spirituality, so much love. It was, a lot more, very, very exciting for me. It changed my life. I came back a changed girl, a changed woman. I had a fire in my heart. I knew that there were there were things that were very unjust, and I had to try to do something. I couldn't just sit back and stay at home and bake cookies and all that stuff and let the world just go on the way it was going on. It was unbearable. When I came back from the Martin Luther King March and I started back working again, of course, at my office with the Farm Labor Program, I was traveling with Bard McAllister. He traveled up and down 99 to all these little communities, and we would just go into a community and find out, what the problems are, talking to people one-on-one, finding out what the needs were, and then putting into action, be it health, housing. He did a lot, and, several people did a lot to build up some infrastructure, like in Allensworth. They had nothing, and it was a community that had been established many years before. It had fallen into great ruin. And he traveled up and down. He took me with him. I guess he felt the fire in my heart. I don't know what it was. But he took me into Delano one day and introduced me to this little short man. And, very humble. To me, it was impossible. I couldn't imagine that this man who looked like maybe my father, that would have worked in the fields, was getting to be such a strong person. And I didn't know at that time when I shook his hand, I was shaking the hand of Cesar Chavez, because the movement had just started. And it was, again, it was unbelievable. That was the summer of 1965, and Bard McAllister and I used to travel to San Francisco all the time to give reports to the main office up there about what was going on. And he brought news to San Francisco about what was going on down in Delano in the grape strike and what's going on. And would go out to the universities and do presentations. And that summer of 1965, Delano became three times the size it was. All kinds of students, university students, came down to help with the effort. The migrant ministries got involved. I mean, all kinds of personages started coming along. And by that time, it was too late to stop. You know, the movement was big, La Causa. It was, well, how can I explain it? My goodness, de colores. It was de colores. Many different people of different colors, of different races came together. That was the first time, besides the Martin Luther King March, I had ever seen people of different races getting together, united for something good. I unfortunately didn't march too much with Cesar Chavez, because remember when I told you that I graduated from high school and I had really good clerical skills? Well, as soon as they found out that I could do all these things, I was appropriated and put to work in the legal department, where we spent our time putting together complaints for the, let me see, it was the ALRB, the American Labor Relations Board, that later became the National Labor Relations Board. And there were complaints about the hiring practices and the working conditions and wages that the farm workers were suffering down in Delano and elsewhere. And, you know, one little thing that many people don't know, many people say, well, yeah, you know, the farm labor movement was begun by Cesar Chavez, but it was not. The farm labor movement has actually been something that's been coming since the days of the Dust Bowls, when Grapes of Wrath was written. We know, and we, for those of us who have read Grapes of Wrath, the living conditions were the same. As you read in the book of the Grapes of Wrath, that's the same way people were living here in those days. So it was a difficult battle, but we all know 40 years later that it worked. At least for those of us who still continue to work in the fields, we had a restroom to go to. We had clean water, because up until then, the only water you could drink was a big tub full of water with one scoop, and everybody had to drink out of that, which nobody ever thought about it. Before I drank my water, I never thought whose lips were on it before. We all did it, you know? And here I am, I'm, you know, 61 years old, I'm alive. But we managed to get that good, clean drinking water. The working conditions got a little bit better in that no longer did we have to use a hose to go down the rows to hoe, which was a killer. You see the old people now that used to work with those hoes, they suffer, they're bent over, and that was, you know, that's a legacy of the people who had to work with a short-handled hose. And I'm sure that many of you will remember that battle to get rid of the short-handled hoe, and that a few years back, it came 2 or 3 years ago, it resurfaced again. They're trying to make it again a short-handled hoe, but I don't think so. I don't think so, unless I would think I'd go and work with a short-handled hoe if I was maybe getting paid $27 an hour. Maybe. And if I could wear my big old shade, you know, but what have you. But anyway, the movement, very exciting. I met a lot of people. We did a lot of things, you know, with a newsletter. What can I say? We all know what happened to the United Farm Workers. It grew and it grew. It grew out of hand. And the only thing now that really hurts me and really hits me in the heart is that in our area right here, they're not active. But that comes a little bit later on. Okay. That's pretty much for my youth. And the marches, the Martin Luther King, Cesar Chavez, I'm honored to have known them. I was standing maybe from here to Janie, from Martin Luther King, but there was a sea of people in between. I wish I had been able to go up and at least touch his hand. I did manage to get a picture of him, and I have it. I carry it with me all the time. So we got through with that. I went to the union. I worked for 7 years. My oldest daughter was born while I was working with the union, doing all kinds of good things. And then I went out. I met the man that would be the father of my three children, and got carried away and smitten. You know how we women have a tendency to fall in love with a man. And so I went and traveled my world, never outside of the United States, but I did travel. I wound up in Washington, D.C., where I had the honor of working with a telemetry division at NASA when they were putting together that first Hubble, not Hubble, that first spacecraft.
Mercury,
the first one? Yeah, well, whichever. I mean, it was exciting because this was the first ship that was going to go out into outer space. And, you know, and was it? Yeah, everybody, the air was all exciting down at NASA. And I was actually getting ready to be certified, high classified, so that I could go into the higher levels because remember my typing fingers? But anyway, guess what? I never did make it. I didn't get my clearance, and I didn't find out until many years later that I was actually blacklisted because of my participation in... Oh, thank you, sweetheart. How did you know my mouth was dry? Oh, that's so good. I also had the honor, of course, I didn't stay there very long. They didn't want me around after they found out that, you know, I'm one of these rabble-rousers and, you know, a troublemaker. So I wound up working with a law professor at Georgetown University who offered me classes so I could become an attorney in exchange for me doing his office work. Well, you know, I did some office work and got tired of it. I didn't want to go to school anymore. School had gotten to me, and I already had a taste of the life. So I didn't go to work. I didn't stay there. And if I had, I don't know what I would have been. Maybe I'd been a Supreme Court justice by now, huh? Jeez. You never know when you turn the corner where you're going to go and the decisions that one makes. And if I had to go back and do it over again, I'd still do the same thing anyway. So I wouldn't have been a Supreme Court justice. I wouldn't want to be in that hot seat anyway. I wandered. I came back. I worked. By the time that I had three children, I was a single working mother. And I worked. Boy, did I. Three jobs at a time, believe it or not. I also had the pleasure of opening the first office of California Rural Legal Assistance in Delano. And I also had the pleasure of being one of the very first employees for what's now the Central California Legal Services. And I worked all over the place. I worked for attorneys. And then I set my own business. I thought to myself, I know a lot of things and I'm a good typist. Remember that, typing fingers? You know, and I'd learned how to do income tax, and I was a notary public, and I thought, I'm ready to go out on my own. You know, I'm tired of having somebody else tell me what to do, so I did. I went out on my own at a time when the consultantes doing income tax, notarizing and writing letters and stuff like that, got really rich. But I didn't get rich. You know, why didn't I get rich? In 3 years, like some of these consultantes I'd seen, I mean, my goodness, they're living in gated communities and everything. Well, doggone it, I was not a very good businesswoman, and I didn't charge you. If I liked you, I wouldn't charge you for doing your job. So no wonder I never got rich. But that's okay. I got rich in so many other ways. I met so many people during that time. And my mother always told me that when you do something good for somebody, and even if they pay you bad, there's somebody up there who's going to pay you good. So you just do what good you can and don't worry about somebody paying you. And I did a lot of good. You know, I did a lot of good for myself because now I'm very knowledgeable about a lot of things. I'm not going to say that I'm an expert, but what's led me now to work with the American Friends Service Committee again, I came back, let me tell you really quickly, when I was in business on my own and I was out there being a starving woman, I mean, good grief, I could barely make enough to pay my bills. And I had never thought, because I love that, I love doing that, I had never thought about getting a job. And one morning I was sitting down with my cup of coffee and picked up the newspaper and this ad just jumped up and grabbed me. And it said, American Friends Service Committee looking for a program assistant. And it told me that I was going to be the one to take that job, believe it or not. And I went in and applied, and I was hired. Bob and Joy Marshall were the hiring committee. And you know what? And my goodness, I don't know why, but you guys went through all that process. I knew that job was going to be mine. Anyway. Yeah, somebody told me. Yeah. But anyway, I came back after all those years, 40 years almost, 30 some odd years. I came back and wound up with the American Friends Service Committee again, where I had started out when I was 19 years old. And I feel that that's, you know, going around full circle. To me, I came 360 degrees. And the program that I had been hired to do to help put together Self-Help Enterprises, by that time I was a board member of Self-Help Enterprises. Now I'm president of the board. So I've come 360 degrees. I worked as program assistant for the Proyecto Campesino, maybe 3 years, I guess, 3 years. And then everything went haywire and everybody decided to retire. And my goodness, in less than 3 years, I went from program assistant to director. How did that happen? When did that happen? I never even knew that, you know. And I broke with tradition again. I've always broken with tradition. Proyecto Campesino has been around 50 years this year. No, last year, 50 years. First time they've had a woman director. I'm it. Yeah. Yes. The program has done much, 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 much good, and I'm hoping that it will continue to do as good as it did under the auspices of Bard McAllister. I'm so honored. I cannot believe that I'm holding the same position now that somebody that I really honored held many years before, so I'm very lucky to be there. My work with Proyecto Campesino, that's my life job. I love that job. People ask me now, are you married? Yes, I'm married. Yeah, well, I'm not married to a man. I'm married to my job. And my associate over there and I, at the present time, are carrying the load. We're carrying the load. And we're loving it. It's a lot of work to go out and organize. We're in the business of organizing people and informing people about things that are going on that are important for their lives. We do that both by one-on-one meetings, by group meetings, and also through the radio, because even though I never planned to be a radio personality, guess what? Again, I broke with tradition, and now I'm doing a two-hour radio show that with Proyecto Campesino. And we're on the air every week, talking to people about what's going on in the world. And believe me, there's a lot going on in the world, particularly now when we're hearing so much immigrants are, I'm sure they're going to be the biggest item in the political agenda besides the war. And we're doing a lot of work raising awareness. We're doing a lot trying to defeat some issues that are coming up, and most particularly the Sensenbrenner King Bill, which we have fought bills all the time, 209, Proposition 209, 187, you name it. You know, every year it seems like there's something coming against the immigrants, which we vilify the immigrants. The immigrants have felt vilified always. And to me, that's so ridiculous, because how many of you are not immigrants, or how many of you didn't come from somewhere else? I mean, the only ones that aren't immigrants, who are they, Uncle Bill? Huh?
The Tachi Yokut.
Huh?
Tachi Yokut. You are ready for a break?
I'm ready for a break.
And then you could
yes.
Tell us about what you're doing now.
I'm coming up to the film and talking about immigrant rights. We do have this film. It's called Rights on the Line. And it's based around all the things that are going on with people crossing the border, coming over here. And people come over here to work. So the American Friends Service Committee provided this film, and I am going to take a little break so we can watch it. It's, 25 minutes long. So thank you for keeping me moving. I told you guys, once I get started, I can't stop.
It came out real good.
You did?